WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Hey Chicago, I'm Susie Yon, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, and we like to spend it looking back and breaking down the biggest stories across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap. Stories like these.
Martinez, a U.S. citizen, was driving to her church when she came upon immigration agents on patrol.
I just looked down and I looked at my hand, it was full of blood.
She was defending her people, something she won't stop doing until there is real change.
As President Trump intensifies his immigration crackdown nationwide, local resistance is also growing.
The ICE Unnotice executive order is a step towards justice.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says every ICE and Border Patrol agent in the area will now wear body cameras.
At the table to help us break it down, Chicago Sun-Times reporter Violet Miller, Axios Chicago reporter and former WBEZ reporter Monica Ng, and David Greising, president of the Better Government Association. First item on the table, ICE and Border Patrol agents will be required to wear body cams, at least in Minneapolis. Violet, kick things off.
Yeah, that's what, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said earlier this week, that she is looking to, you know, issue these body-worn cameras. This is another kind of, seemingly half-baked move to bring some kind of reaction or accountability step back into what we normally consider reining in law enforcement with, you know, these federal officials, right? We saw in the Chicago area during the temporary restraining order that, you know, some agents here were wearing body cameras, and still we saw, you know, tear gassings, we saw pepper balls used, we saw shootings. And so, if this changes anything, you know, that'll remain to be seen. But we should be seeing more actually government-issued body-worn cameras instead of some of the GoPro cameras agents here were wearing.
Right. And as you mentioned, body cams is one way the Department of Homeland Security seems to be responding to pressure after the fatal shooting of Alex Pretty. President Trump's border czar Tom Homan also announced yesterday that it was removing 700 ICE agents from the field there in Minneapolis. David, Monica, could this be the start of a more accountable ICE, or do you see these as more surface-level changes?
I think it's clearly a little bit of window dressing, and of course we have to wait to see what comes down the pike here in Chicago and Illinois. You know, it's been said that ICE will be back, border control agents will be back this spring. And if indeed that happens, let's see what these new practices, whether body cameras, whether more identifiable information on their dress makes any difference. Certainly the signaling from all the other executive people aside from Homan has not been in favor of calming things down. In fact, they've thrown fuel on the fire of all the outrage because of the kind of misinformation and immediate accusatory reaction they have whenever somebody has been shot, and trying to make these people seem like they're terrorists or something, when in fact we have found they are either just typical residents of the cities in question, or in the case of Alex Pretty, a nurse at a Veterans Administration hospital.
Right. Or in the case of Miramar Martinez, you know, a teaching assistant in Chicago who was born in Chicago. And even if they do remove 700 agents there, they still started with 3,000.
Right.
You know, and keep in mind, we just had a few hundred here in big Chicago, and they had 3,000 in tiny Twin Cities.
Yeah. Well, one front in attempting to hold ICE accountable is what local police officers can or cannot do when federal agents shoot someone or pepper spray someone. David, Mayor Brandon Johnson issued an executive order that would redefine the role Chicago police could play. What are the details there?
Well, it's called the ICE on Notice Executive Order, and basically it encourages Chicago police to begin investigations when they see something that they believe is illegal. This has led to an odd sort of struggle between the city and the state's attorney, Eileen O'Neill Burke, who is basically saying sort of not her job to investigate, certainly, and they're raising significant questions about whether, in fact, she would ever prosecute if a case were brought to her. This is not unique to Chicago. We've seen this in other cities around the country. It's likely that this is more sort of grandstanding on Mayor Johnson's part than it is a serious permanent part of law enforcement. It does raise the question of states' rights or city rights in this case compared to federal authority. And the federal authorities have made it very clear they're not having any of this. They're not sharing information in the shootings up in the Pratty shooting, for example, up in Minneapolis. They, in fact, blocked local investigators from investigating that shooting. And we can expect to see if, in fact, the mayor's executive order is acted on, we can expect to see the same sort of resistance from federal authorities if it happens here in Chicago.
Right.
Cook County authorities tell me, you know, they were pretty upset that I even mentioned a possible collaboration between police and Cook County State's Attorney's Office. They're like, you need to issue a correction. I said, all I said is that the mayor aims to have cooperation. They're hot as hornets over this because they say that they can only prosecute if they have lots of good physical evidence, if they have a strong case, and if the feds don't take it away from them and they don't see, they see only the narrowest path towards that kind of strong case. And they said that the mayor never got the wording approved and yet said during the press conference, oh, yes, we've worked closely with them. So tons of back and forth this week. And, you know, the bottom line is it's unclear if, you know, we just saw the LAPD chief say, I'm not going to enforce the face mask ban on ICE agents. So it's unclear if CPB, if the Chicago Police Department will actually be able to monitor or enforce anything. I mean, I think what the executive order says is they're going to watch, monitor, try to get IDs, try to document things. But there's a lot of tension there. And I've talked to officials who don't want to see greater antagonism between cops with guns and feds with guns.
Right. And I want to stick with you there on Monica on that. I mean, you looked into why federal agents seem to have so much more leeway than local police and face less accountability overall. What did you find?
Well, it's the supremacy clause, which the feds believe grants them, you know, the vice president has that absolute immunity, then he kind of backtracked, but certainly broad immunity for what they're doing in the line of duty. And so I've been working on the story for weeks and months. I've been begging Chicago Police Department, hey, can you give me some sort of statement on this? FOP, can you give me some sort of statement on it? Nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So I was thrilled when former police chief Gary McCarthy went on Fox Chicago and started talking about it. And he said, quote, he said, there's no law enforcement agency in the country that could get away with the things that DHS agents are doing and not expect blowback. I was like, OK, thank you very much for that quote. He also said that you don't stand in front of vehicles. You don't shoot into a moving vehicle because if you get that million and one kill shot, you've got a 2,000-pound bullet riding down the street, which is what happened in Minneapolis. At the same time, he said he doesn't understand why he believes he's probably talking about Pritzker and Brandon Johnson. Local leaders are saying resist because he believes that that's telling people to resist law enforcement. He said if a cop is arresting you, and even if it's an unlawful arrest, if you resist arrest, you are breaking the law. He said you can be arrested for a robbery and found innocent, but you can still be prosecuted for resisting arrest.
Yeah. Well, David, you're the head of the Better Government Association. What should the federal government do after an ICE or Border Patrol agent engages in alleged abuse? I mean, the feds are automatically barring state and local officials from doing any kind of investigation. What should be the best practice there?
Well, what should be best practice is that, as has happened historically, is that there is an investigation of if there's a shooting, for example, the FBI comes in and investigates. You don't have the Attorney General of the country basically saying nothing to see here, let's move on. The problem here that we have is a breakdown in trust because the leadership is being so outspoken in terms of demonizing the victims and basically giving the shooters and or others who may have had questionable conduct kind of a free pass. And that's why we see local authorities trying to step in, because the communities that both federal and local authorities represent have a right to law enforcement that protects them and doesn't terrorize them. And what the local authorities are seeing is that their communities are being terrorized and made unsafe by the behaviors of these federal agents, and the federal government is not cracking down. So it's not surprising to see people like Mayor Johnson and other mayors across the country trying to step in. I don't think at present we're going to see any kind of federal oversight in any meaningful way, sadly, because of what they're hearing from the leadership at the top.
Right. Well, Violet, before Alex Preti and Renee Good were killed in Minneapolis, a federal agent shot and killed suburban Chicago resident Silverio Villegas Gonzalez back in September. The feds barred local law enforcement from getting involved there. What's happened since?
Not a whole lot. And that's exactly what we're looking at here. I mean, when the feds are handling the investigation of the feds, you know, it's not really going anywhere, which is why, you know, as David said, we're seeing these local authorities try to step in. But again, there's only so much they can do. A lot of these measures are, you know, kind of banking on collecting information in the hopes that an investigation will come of it. But that's just not how things are operating. So in a sense, a lot of these responses are, you know, almost acclimated to the world that we used to live in, not the world that we currently live in, right? But, you know, after that, we saw Miramar Martinez, you know, shot in Brighton Park. And, you know, she was acquitted after being accused and called a terrorist, which she's now seeking to get, you know, an apology from the federal government or retraction on their end, which they seem to be, you know, refusing to give, though, you know, we'll see if that changes as she appears at the State of the Union. But, you know, she's speaking out now. She's saying that she is the voice of Alex Preti and she is the voice of Renee Good because she survived. And by extension, also Keith Porter and Silvera Villegas Gonzalez, who were also killed by federal immigration agents. And so, you know, again, we haven't even seen much. I mean, she's fighting in court just to get the evidence from her case released to show how the feds respond when they do this, to show kind of the playbook of where, you know, as David said, they pin this blame on folks before, you know, investigators can even get to the scene.
This is the weekly news recap here on In the Loop, a chance for us to go deep on the biggest local headlines of the week. I'm Susie Ahn, and I'm here with Violet Miller of the Sun-Times, Monica Eng from Axios Chicago, and David Greising from the Better Government Association. Sticking there with Miramar's story, Monica, I mean, your thoughts on that. You know, protesters are immediately labeled as domestic terrorists, which is what happened to Miramar Martinez. Anyone in a vehicle like Martinez or Renee Good is said to be trying to ram or run over agents when video shows otherwise. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's a playbook that they've used from the beginning. It seems like the nation has woken up to these statements you get from DHS are actually easily provably false. I've known that since I've been getting statements from them since earlier this year. I've been shocked. You know, I've covered a lot of governments. I've been shocked at the bald face lies, they just keep pumping them out and then they don't take them down. I mean, there was that one where Tricia McLaughlin showed a video of a young woman in Hoffman Estates getting tackled on her lawn. And she tweeted, "Look at that. It's Chicago police getting a burglar in Chicago." When that was proven every which way is wrong, she still hasn't taken it down. The Miramar Martinez, a domestic terrorist, still not taken down. I think there's this like never explain, never apologize, never take down falsehoods. I don't get it.
Yeah. David, what do you make of that? I mean, how would you characterize that? Propaganda? Denial?
I think it's part of a concerted effort to kind of sway public opinion. And, you know, in a sense, it's possibly working with a large number of people. The thing is, you know, the group around the table here, we all pay really careful attention to all the backing and forthing. But as Monica's saying, if you never back down, if you just keep saying this, if you keep pounding away at it, including the president of the United States, people are very swayed by that kind of authority. We've been raised to sort of trust the people in these kind of offices. And so when they keep repeating it, even if it's a falsehood, it's adopted by quite a few people, even those who are not politically inclined toward that necessarily. Of course, those who are politically inclined toward very anti-immigrant mindset, which is common. I mean, this is successful in part because people in the U.S. across the board are concerned about immigration. They do want the borders to be secure. They do. They want to be protected from anybody who comes in who maybe is in some way a threat. The thing is that such a tiny proportion, as studies have shown, the numbers are no different on in the immigrant population than they are on the rest of the population. But it's very easy to demonize immigrants.
Right. Well, I want to talk about the case of Juan Espinoza Martinez. The feds accused him of putting a bounty on the head of Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino. A jury acquitted him, saying there was not enough evidence, but he's still behind bars. And the government tried to deport him. David, what's the latest there?
Yeah, well, this kind of summarizes a lot of what we're talking about. The jury took about 3 hours to find him not guilty. Judge Joan Lefkoe said that the evidence, there basically was no evidence against him. The big claim, the scary claim, was that he was a leader of the Latin Kings gang and he was trying to put a hit on Gregory Bovino. As soon as he was found not guilty, though, he was taken by federal agents down to a prison in Indiana, and efforts were initiated to deport him, basically. There's been a hold put on that. It's going to be argued out in court. He's fortunate in a sense because not everybody has been protected that way, and some people we've seen flown out of the country to who knows where. He will get a fair hearing eventually, and whether he is here illegally, et cetera, will be disputed prior to exporting. And meanwhile, he waits in jail after being found not guilty of the crime for which he was charged.
Right. Violet, I want to turn to another case here. We all remember the raid on the South Shore apartment building back in September. That happened in the middle of the night. 37 people detained, including children. The government filmed the entire thing and put it out on social media. And new documents reveal that what the government was saying was about the raid didn't really match reality. What is the latest there?
Yeah, well, there's been a number of breaks on this story recently. My colleague Sophie Sherry reported this week that the owners and managers of the building actually okayed the raid, were cooperating with federal agents. And so, you know, that's you know, an interesting thing. That's after the Illinois Department of Human Rights opened up a case into the management company and the ownership. So we'll see what comes of that. You know, again, these are state and local officials trying to intervene and hold people to account where they can. It's really hard to hold the federal government to account, but it's much easier when they're local landlords or management companies, right? We have laws in place to do that. But, you know, we've seen, you know, as documents have come out about this raid, you know, the government had, I mean, this is also something my colleague Sophie Sherry reported earlier on this. You know, the government had a decent amount of information going into this raid. They, you know, the agents were marking doors with occupied, unoccupied, even weapons and some, and leaving some apartments alone while raiding others. And so, you know, there's been a lot of questions about, you know, kind of what was going on, what prompted this, how did they know, how did they get all this information? And so the pieces are starting to, you know, come together on this. Again, you know, there were allegations that there were immigrants squatting in the building, and you know that is what the you know, seemingly prompted the building owners to cooperate with federal agents. So again, just more and more information coming out on this, as my colleague called it, a made-for-TV raid.
Yeah. Well, quickly as we head to a break, there's been word, of course, that ICE and Border Patrol plan to return to Chicago in greater numbers in the spring. Violet, any more info on that?
Nothing yet that, you know, I've been able to get from my sources. I know that, you know, a lot of folks were starting to get cut out of information circles last year because of how much the movement of federal immigration agents was being leaked to, you know, the press, the public, in a variety of different ways. So I haven't heard anything on that yet, but, you know, obviously they're jumping city to city. It's something that, you know, you can feel the city is bracing for. I've heard, you know, folks in my neighborhood talking about it. You know, I still see people with whistles out all the time. You know, Chicago, it never stopped being prepared for that. So it's really just a matter of when they come back.
Is there any indication that the effort to, like, put that out there is just part of the plan to have us all worrying all the time about.
It very well could be. I mean, I can't say, you know, for a fact, but it very much seems it. I mean, people are kept on edge. You know, people are afraid. They don't leave their homes. You know, we've seen immigrant communities talk about, how tough it is just to go to the grocery store, just to get your kids from school. And we've seen a lot of folks step up in that way in helping out. But, fear has definitely been a hallmark of this administration.
The psychological aspect seems to be very important.
The Illinois primary election, it has started. Election day is March 17th, but early voting has already begun in some parts of the listening area. We have mail-in voting starting too. Violet, fill us in on some key dates and info people should keep in mind.
Yeah, so as you said, early voting already started by mail February 5th, February 12th, so a week from yesterday. Early voting will start at the downtown supersite and the Chicago Board of Elections office. And February 18th, we have the first day of grace period for in-person voter registration and voting at election authority and early voting sites. That'll continue all the way through election day. March 1st is the last day for online voter registration. March 2nd, the 50 ward early voting sites will open across the city. So each ward has their own one. Check to make sure where the closest is to you. March 12th will be the last day for the election authority to receive vote by mail applications. So that's not the ballots, that's applications. And then, as you said, March 17th is primary election day. Polls are open 6 a.m. to 7 p.m.
And Monica, there's a change in for mail-in voters. What do folks need to know there?
They need to know to get your mail-in ballot early, because now they're going to be stamping it with the processing date, not the mailing date. So you can put it in your box, and if it's not picked up for a day or so, it's not. And if you put it on election day, it's not going to be stamped with election day, and it could be invalid. So again, you can bring them to those 50 boxes, or you can bring it to the post office and say, can you stamp it right in front of me? But you cannot count on it being counted as election day voting if you just put it in the mailbox. They're going to do it with the date that they actually stamp it at the post office.
And how do you all vote? Are you early voters, mail-in, day of?
I'm in person, day of. Ooh. Precinct girl.
Old that way too.
Yeah, I go early in person. I work election day, so I'm usually doing the live coverage through the day. So I don't have too much time, unfortunately.
My polling place is typically pretty quiet on the morning of, so yeah, I keep it day of too.
Or early sometimes on really quiet days. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, there's an eerie backdrop to this primary. President Trump has announced he wants to, quote, nationalize elections. The FBI recently seized some voting records from Georgia, and it's a little unclear what's going on there. The president still continues to lie, saying he won the 2020 election, which he lost. How concerned are you about all of this?
Well, it's clearly a concerted effort on the part of the Trump administration, A, to undermine kind of trust in elections. And this talk about nationalizing elections, while it's, you know, contrary to what's very explicit in the Constitution of the United States, that states run elections, clearly the president is arguing differently, and he wishes to ignore that and find a way around that restriction. He's getting some support from his Republican base for this. I think the idea of any party controlling elections nationally is understandably scary. But the administration is now kind of moving forward on this, in part by seizing records from not just what we've seen in Fulton County, Georgia, but states across the country. It looks as if the administration is trying to put facts on the ground that would dictate and try to force some sort of federal control. The argument for federal control is cybersecurity, is standard, you know, electoral standards. It's all about sort of the back office part of running an election. And some of the states acknowledge that they could use some help in these areas. On the other hand, the political impact of it would be pretty considerable and is of concern in many states across the country.
For sure. Violet, Monica, any reaction? I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that we recently passed the 5-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection, when Trump supporters wanted to, quote, stop the steal and storm the Capitol.
I mean, I think it's just jarring. It's really horrifying to see, you know, the idea of nationalizing elections, putting it under one party like that. I mean, just the implications of that. I forget where I'm borrowing this from, but somebody said this week that, you know, it seems that the Trump administration is hell-bent on becoming one of the countries that it is sending people back to that have, you know, come here from. And so it really seems as if, you know, obviously there are the arguments they make about cybersecurity, but it's, you know, as you said, these kind of bald-faced statements that you know exactly what they mean when they're saying these things. You know, it's pretty clear that they are vying for more control of elections. And, you know, in a democracy, that just doesn't really work with it being a democracy.
Yeah. And the Constitution explicitly puts elections under states' purview. So I would imagine it would be tough for constitutional lawyers to accept this.
And those of us who remember, like, going back to the Bush v. Gore election, when it was the state of Florida and the Secretary of State of Florida who she had to determine, and people complained that this was a party, you know, there was party influence there. But you'd rather see it happen on such a microscopic level as opposed to a national level where a party would have the power, a lot more power than an individual Secretary of State typically might.
Yeah. Well, coming back to Illinois, Monica, the highest profile contest in Illinois is the race to replace retiring U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. The Democrat has been in Congress for nearly 40 years, and this is the state's first open Senate seat in a decade. There are three front runners on the Democratic side: Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. How are they working to distinguish themselves from each other?
Well, it's really interesting because their stances on ICE or Trump seem to be one big part of it. Raja Krishnamoorthy says he wants to abolish Trump's ICE. And by that, he means, and I asked him specifically, masks off, cameras on, reduce funding. Robin Kelly has put forth this proposal to impeach Kristi Noem that's actually gotten quite a lot of co-sponsors. Juliana Stratton says she's the only one who's actually saying straight out abolish ICE. Also, she wants to see CBP off the border, and she wants to see immunity removed from federal agents. So that's kind of one of the biggest things they're talking about. On top of that, where their money's coming from.
Right. Krishnamoorthy's
been, you know, criticized for having, quote unquote, Trump donors among his donors. And Juliana Stratton has been criticized for getting a big chunk of change from J.B. Pritzker indirectly through this super PAC. So lots of mud is flying. They all are generally pretty aligned on policy, but they're trying to find differences.
Yeah. This big Pritzker contribution that just happened in the last week or so is pretty interesting because until then, there was a lot of chatter in the political class about, well, yeah, J.B. Pritzker endorsed her, but he really hasn't done anything for her. Does he really want her to be elected? And I think he's now sort of put his money where his mouth is, and I think we can expect a headier support from the governor as Election Day approaches.
Even stumping, you know,
right,
so
right.
5 million votes for her plus stumping.
Yeah, lots of money there. Well, I noticed that the Chicago Tribune has started publishing its endorsements for key congressional races. Of course, the Chicago Sun-Times no longer issues endorsements since joining WBEZ as part of Chicago Public Media. We need to note that. So, question for all of you. Where do you tend to look for info about specific candidates you might not be familiar with when you're preparing to vote?
I would say I've been reading the Tribune endorsements, mindful of the fact that because Chicago Public Media is a nonprofit and legally is not allowed to endorse candidates, that is now the lone voice. And it used to be that you could rely on the Sun-Times and the Tribune and kind of triangulate between those two editorial stances. And there were others here and there. But in terms of legacy media, we only get that one voice. And the Tribune, of course, historically has been a more conservative voice than a lot of our people in our community. I will say that reading the editorial endorsements this year, I think they're making they seem to recognize the responsibility, and they're less partisan than they used to be. And in fact, because these are primary elections, they don't typically endorse in primary elections, they're giving you a lot of really strong body language about who they think is strong and who they think is not. But it's a very helpful voice that we otherwise would kind of be relatively blind.
Yeah, unless you do your own research and go, you know, sort of policy to policy to policy. That's what we have to do as Axios prepares its own voter guide.
I was going to say, that's what I do every year. I've been lucky to be a part of our voter guides here at the Sun-Times pretty much since I joined on. And so, you know, doing the research obviously is part of it, but We have such a unique media ecosystem in Chicago where we have so many, you know, voices. We might not have the second editorial voice, but I mean, you know, between Axios and the Reader, independent folks, you know, the Sun-Times and WBEZ voter guides. I mean, there's just such a plethora of information out there in Justice Watch. I mean, everybody is doing these voter guides from, you know, every race down ballot. So there really is just you got to get out there and do your research. It's important.
That's right, listeners. Well, David, the governor's race, it seems a little sleepy. Are there any viable challengers to Governor J.B. Pritzker as he seeks a third term?
Well, it's going to be really hard for anybody to beat Governor Pritzker, not just because he's built a pretty strong record, but also because he has a ton of money to throw into a race. And it's very important, obviously, for him to win so he can now run for president. And we all have to be mindful of that's really what's going on here. That said, the Republican field is pretty interesting. We have Darren Bailey, who ran against Pritzker last time, came out of the primary having beaten the mayor of Aurora, who had Ken Griffin money mm-hmm. behind him in order to do that. And Bailey has a lot of support downstate and also got a lot of support in suburban Chicago. He's up against three other candidates. One notable one, a name that may be familiar, is Ted Dabrowski, who has written a million op-eds over the years and is a very thoughtful, arch-conservative fiscal person. Their debate the other night was they had a hard time sort of finding an ability to stake out differences amongst them. And the big issue was crime. They're using crime as their big issue, even though we've seen a reduction in crime in Chicago and nationally. And in fact, the Tribune coverage of the story said they're even President Trump is bragging about the reduction in increased crime. And the Tribune story noted that these candidates are stuck in the position of worrying us all about a crime wave that the president says no longer exists. And so it's a little bit of a tricky issue for them, but still crime is a big issue, especially among Republican voters. And you can expect them to continue to go after that, the Safety Act, the cash-free bail system, et cetera. They are big on immigration as well, mm-hmm. But there's not a lot to separate the different positions of the four candidates.
Right. Well, I want to turn to another story that broke this week. Violet, an R. Kelly survivor, previously known as Jane Doe, has broken her silence in a new memoir. Tell us about Rashona Landfair.
Yeah, so she earlier this week, the first public interview she's ever done, published with Rolling Stone. You know, previously the only bits that we had heard from her story were in, you know, court testimony in that 2022 trial. And so now, you know, she's releasing this memoir, Who's Watching Shorty, this week. And I have to say, I read it in one sitting. It's pretty enthralling, you know, as somebody who was not old enough to follow the first case, but definitely followed the second one. You know, just seeing everything from her perspective was really interesting. But she goes through a lot of the detail of, you know, not just the, you know, trials themselves, but also the lead up to, you know, when she met R. Kelly, when she was, you know, being groomed and going through all of this. And so, you know, just hearing that story and watching it develop from her perspective was really interesting. But it's clear that, you know, she's out here to reclaim her name. She said that, you know, she's gone by nicknames for years to avoid the, you know, the kind of ridicule she faced. Because in the 2008 trial, you know, her name came out. She was not protected by prosecutors in that sense. And so, you know, this is her reclaiming her name, she says, and also speaking up for other survivors. You know, the book ends on a note to other folks who have faced that kind of abuse. It has, you know, lists of resources that, you know, she may not have had access to that she's, you know, kind of putting on this pedestal. So, you know, as somebody who works in healthcare and education in Chicago, it makes sense that she's trying to reach out and you know, use what platform she has for this.
Oh, yeah. On the recap, we occasionally take a look at the state of the media. And Monica, a significant change at the Alt Weekly, the Chicago Reader. Well, I guess we can't really say Alt Weekly anymore,
can we? Alt Monthly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is like the 10th facelift for the Reader as it's gone through, you know, sadly, a lot of different evolutions and owners. They're going monthly, and the new edition came out this week. I'm going to pick it up as I leave Navy Pier. It's going to feature long form again. It's going to look a bit like The Stranger, which is its sister publication now that it's owned by Noisy Creek, Stranger out of Seattle. It's going to have something called the Reader Radar, where it's a curated list of cool things to do that month. Jonathan Rosenbaum, the venerable film critic, is coming back to talk about current events through the lens of films. That's going to be interesting. And I'm hoping that they'll bring back some like nostalgic stuff for oldsters like me.
Okay.
Like, here's my suggestion, Sarah Conway, new editor. Bring back some old Cartoon Kitchens or Ernie Pook's comics or some classic Mike Minor columns from Hot Type.
Oh.
That can get people like me who remember the days of Bob Roth and Tom Yoder and Alison True and Dave Kerr. Do some nostalgia stuff. It's cheap, too. But I'm looking forward to opening it up and seeing what this new alt-monthly looks like.
And pair that nostalgia with new voices, because Sarah has said she really wants to elevate younger, newer voices.
Yes, yes.
And we needed the next generation of those iconic names that you just listed in the Reader. That's what always distinguished the Reader, is those specialists and those people who really had voice.
Yeah, and had the space to do something long form.
Yeah, nostalgia is big in getting the older dollars.
Yes.
Older eyes.
Who has older subscribers and readers? I don't know.
Well, I want to turn to another massive media industry story this week. A bit sadder. The Washington Post laid off about a third of its newsroom staff this week. That's 300 journalists, at least one of them based here in Chicago. David, I mean, that was unsettling, to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. One thing, though, struck me of 300 and still have two-thirds of your staff left shows how much bigger newspaper than many others, just about any other in the country other than the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, probably. But that said, huge, huge cuts, elimination of iconic coverage like the Post's international coverage, the book review, which is like one – probably the best in the country by some measures, competing with the New York Times, will go away. You know, I've looked at this in the terms of the arc of the Jeff Bezos ownership. If you read like Marty Baron's book about the Bezos standing up to Trump, not meddling with the newsroom at all in those early years, and Marty Baron, the former editor of the Washington of the Boston Globe, who did the Catholic abuse series and then came to the Post and really turned it around, and in fact, together, they came up with the slogan "Democracy Dies in Darkness," which is attributed originally to Bob Woodward. That was the spirit of the Post at the time, but the decline really begins with the 2026 election, when Jeff Bezos eliminated the editorial page. Essentially, he said that they were going to talk mainly or almost exclusively about personal liberty and free markets, and we're not going to do an endorsement. And you can track the editorial decline from then to now. And also, he initially kind of rebuilt the user experience, et cetera. He's stopped investing. He's been losing a lot of money. He can afford to lose a lot of money, and he said he wanted to lose a lot of money. What he's worried about is the Post causing his other business interests trouble, and he has rolled over for the Trump administration, for President Trump, just like many other business leaders have.
Melania documentary.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And so the most notable recent event was the raid on a reporter's home by federal agents. And the Post and Jeff Bezos, the owner, was silent on that. Jeff Bezos was silent on that. That's the sort of thing in the early days he probably would have said something. He's been completely silent. So it's a sad day for journalism, and it's a sad day for this iconic newspaper that stood up to the Nixon administration and I think encouraged a certain generation of journalists, myself and perhaps Monica included. I'm a little older than Monica, but
I saw
it's
all the
one of the reasons
men.
We became journalists. And so we're losing not just the losses at that newspaper, but what symbolically it means in the country.
And I want to send a shout out to Kim Bellware, a very accomplished local reporter for the Washington Post, who contacted me to say that she lost her job in this sweep as well. Anybody in Chicago media want to check out Kim's work, you should contact her.
A great name, great writer. Huge shakeup on the media landscape here. Well, I'm going to make a really hard turn now, folks. On a much lighter note, voting is underway in Chicago's You Name a Snowplow contest, which runs through February 14th. There are 25 finalists. Any favorites?
Well, this
among
is
you?
The most important election this year.
That's right.
I want everybody to know and remember that. It's nice, Derek Froese, to, you know, yet another honor for him after he gets his banner hung at the United Center.
Claro, mija, es mueve la nieve, which means move the snow in Spanish. I'm practicing also my Bad Bunny moves for the Sunday.
Right.
And I look back to the history of Chicago, and I have to love Daniel Burnham. that's a
but
pretty
not
good one.
So great, Caleb Chilliams. I do like Pope Frio.
Pope Frio, that's pretty good.
And of course, the top contender, Abolish ICE, which it was 80% of the voting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was far and away the number one pick.
Well, I'm going to shout out Kevin McPlowister.
I didn't get that. That's like
Home Alone.
Yeah,
yeah.
See,
yeah.
You got to think with some of those.
Also, maybe a little nod to Catherine O'Hara in there.
I love that tribute. Yeah, that's nice.
Well, speaking of the roads, Cook County has launched an e-ticket pilot program that could shorten and digitize the process of paying tickets for traffic violations. I don't know. I guess that's a good thing.
Yay. You get your tickets sooner.
Really exciting. Oh,
hoo-hoo. Yeah.
That's good government. Yeah.
Cook County is going to be delivering those tickets faster the e-way.
There's nothing they do more efficiently than collect your money.
So. Right. Good for them. Good for them, I guess. Well, I also found it very funny earlier this week on Groundhog Day when Punxsutawney Phil predicted 6 more weeks of winter, yet Woodstock Willie in Woodstock, Illinois, predicted an early spring.
I say Woodstock Willie.
Yeah.
Who cares about Punxsutawney?
Tuesday's going to be over 40. I'm leaning towards Woodstock Willie. I think that he's got it this year.
Yeah. I mean, I really think we're just in for another typical Chicago schmarch, where it's we're going to get fooled. Full spring, back to winter, back to spring, back to winter, and then suddenly summer. I think that's what we're headed towards.
As it goes.
Well, you know, I'm sure that you've all seen the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray.
Over and over again.
The same day over and over again. It got me thinking, if there was one story you wish you didn't have to live over and over, because
okay,
it feels like we are living stories over and over again. What would you like to
first
eliminate?
I'm sorry to steal it from you guys. I do not want to cover any more just traumatic ICE raids in Chicago ever again. Sorry to take it.
No, our minds were all in the same place. Like if we never have to see, you know, the devastation in the wake of that ever again, if we never have to deal with chemical agents or see our neighbors deal with chemical agents, I mean, that would be lovely.
Right, absolutely.
Gosh, you guys have left me a tough one. I guess I would never want again to see a story about wait until next year for any of our Chicago sports teams.
Oh, right. Yes.
After looking at the Bulls this week after the trade deadline, ended up with, I think, like 20 second-round picks and no first-round picks.
Who are they going to get rid of now, Benny the Bull? I mean, it's just like, talk about ripping that team apart. Yeah. And, we were all so hopeful about the Bears. How about getting a winning team? No more, wah-wah, we did okay.
Baseball's just around the corner. I'm saying,
okay. Wait until next year. Wait until next year.
The Cubs are looking good.
Looking at spring then. Well, as we wrap up here, I'll ask each of you, what's one story you'll be keeping an eye on for next week? Monica?
Well, I am doing a very big investigation of curfew apprehensions and where they are the highest and where they are the lowest in the city of Chicago. And you will never guess where they are the lowest. Should I tell you? I can't. I'm just going to scoop myself. Thanks, editor.
Keep readers reading.
Read on Monday, and you will find a blockbuster story. So, and we're going to be voting on a new curfew ordinance later this month, supposedly. So that's why I'm doing it.
All right, Violet.
Yeah, I'm covering the Cook County Assessor's race, so I am knee deep in campaign finances. So I'm sure you will all be hearing more about that. In addition to, the latest in queer news next week.
All right, David.
I hate to betray my good government pedigree, but I'm going to be paying very careful attention to Governor Pritzker's budget address. Although, come to think of it, it's not this week, it's next week. So, I'll be preparing. I'll be preparing. But I want to thank Monica for her systematic approach to stories like curfew. It's really great when she goes out and and really explores what's happening across the city like that.
Got to file those FOIAs.
That's right. Well, that's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to my colleague Violet Miller of the Sun-Times, my former colleague Monica Ng of Axios Chicago, and David Greising of the Better Government Association. Great talking news with all of you.
Thanks, Susie. Have a great weekend.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Dan Tucker. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. And thanks for listening.